I think we'll bring the meeting to order here as people are gathering their stuff and take care of some preliminary things. Is there... Representative Murphy, will you move the minutes from the last meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of the minutes from the last meeting, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? They are adopted. We have some re-referrals to the Licensing Subcommittee. House File 1070 and Senate File 26 are re-referred to the Licensing Subcommittee. And as one more preliminary matter, House File 1729 is the governor's healthy exchange initiative, and it needs to move through several committees. It's in House File 842, which is the governor's budget, which is staying within the jurisdiction of our committee. So we will be looking at it. But what I'd like to do is delete out the parts, the Minnesota Care parts, and send the parts that need to go to Commerce and Taxes as a separate bill so they can deal with the policy issues related to that. So could we, I guess I'll move to House File 1729, be moved without recommendation to the Committee on Commerce. So that motion is before us, and there are two amendments to it. The first is the 208 amendment, which is a technical amendment. Does everybody have that in their packets? Any questions on that amendment? All right, all in favor of the 208 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That amendment is adopted. And then this A1 amendment is actually taking out the Minnesota Care provisions of the bill, so it's being sent on to Commerce and Taxes with just the health exchange and the 125 plan piece for their consideration. And again, we still have jurisdiction, and I am committed that we will take up those pieces of it in a separate discussion. Representative Broad, do you want to...
Mr. Chairman, is the thought then that those other pieces would be included or not included, whatever the case may be, in the omnibus bills, for example, of taxes, or what will happen? Will the commerce piece come back here?
No, Representative Broad, it won't come back here. I think it will be referred to finance, but end up in Representative Huntley's finance committee. And we will also discuss it because we have an 842. It'll still be with us as well to discuss.
Mr. Chairman, then will the tax piece end up with Representative Lincheski's committee or Representative Huntley? Would that be a part of your bill?
Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, it's not clear to me yet what the Senate's going to do, and we're going to have to match up with them. Ultimately, this will either be part of the big omnibus bill, or it will be there will be a separate health reform bill. But all these items would be in one of those two bills. I mean, I would my personal preference is to have a separate health care reform bill that would include those things of the governor that we can agree with and those things that the House comes up with as well.
And Representative Broad, you know, we talked about this a little bit beforehand, but on probably next week, likely on Tuesday, we'll be doing a lot of those pieces, and so we'll be talking about the exchange, for instance, next Tuesday, and the 125 piece of it as health policy, and then so moving or not moving, but those pieces would then be referred directly to Representative Huntley's committee. So on the A1 amendment, just to clean it up for what Commerce and Taxes needs, all in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? The motion is adopted. Then I would just like to renew my motion that 1729 be referred without recommendation to the Commerce Committee for their consideration. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 All opposed? That motion is adopted and the bill will be re-referred. Okay. Representative Norton, House Senate File 555. And Representative Norton moves that Senate File 555 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Tracy, and then members. I'm bringing forward today a simple bill that passed through the Senate very quickly, and hopefully we'll have a positive experience here. This bill deals with essential community providers who are healthcare providers that serve uninsured, high-risk, and special needs populations. Health plan companies are required to offer contracts to the ECPs, and this bill is going to allow the commissioner to designate additional ECPs, and one of the ways it does that is by eliminating the time limit that was mentioned in the original legislation. It lifts that. It also discusses renewals and an adjustment to fees, and I do have some testifiers who can talk to the bill and perhaps answer questions as well.
Mr. Griffin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Phil Griffin. I am a lobbyist representing the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I have with me today Rhonda Degelow, who is the executive director of the association, and who would like to give you a brief explanation of the bill. If I can, before she goes into her explanation, she will talk a little bit about them. But this client is a unique client made up of a group of providers who are federally qualified health care clinics that, as Representative Burton outlined, treat poor people. In 1992, when we started the major health care reform legislation that resulted in Minnesota Care, we also were concerned about a number of things that were going to occur in the marketplace as those changes move forward. One of them was the concern that many of these clinics that treated special populations might be left behind, and that was the reason for the adoption of the essential community provider status. I want to make sure that we have an amendment that I know is at the table today. We also want to make sure that you're aware that I represent several hats, as many committee members know. The health plans do not have an objection to this legislation, so as we move forward, I want to let members know that. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Norton, maybe we can move the amendment briefly to get the bill in the shape the author wants it. So, Representative Norton, you want to move the 201 amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the author's 201 amendment.
And Representative Norton, as I understand, this takes care of concerns that the health department has.
It does indeed. The health department approached me and was concerned about the wording, and this just clarifies the wording.
Okay. Any discussion to the amendment, members? Seeing none, all in favor of the 201 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I turn the comments over to Ms. Degelow.
Ms. Degelow, please identify yourself for the record if you would. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhonda Degelow. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. And I do have packets of information for the committee members if there's somebody who could distribute those.
Thank you.
The association represents a group of clinics who've been designated essential community providers, or ECPs, for a number of years. I'm here to support House File 918, which would extend the current ECP designation program. I'd like to share a few highlights from the packets that are being circulated. Minnesota's 17 community health centers are medical homes for 180,000 patients. These health centers are located throughout the state, with 11 in the metro area and 6 in greater Minnesota. The patients served by these health centers are predominantly low income. 86% of them have incomes below 200% of federal poverty guidelines. 42% of them are uninsured, and 35% are covered by MA, Minnesota Care, and GAMC. Two-thirds of them are from culturally diverse backgrounds, including Latino, African American, Asian, and Native American. Minnesota's community health centers provide primary and preventive health services, including medical, dental, and mental health. As you might expect, given the socioeconomic status and cultural diversity of these patients, the incidence of chronic disease is much higher in this patient population. And so all of these health centers are actively engaged in programs to prevent and closely manage diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and depression. These health centers also provide services to make healthcare more accessible to people with special needs, such as language translation, transportation, and case management. All of them provide community outreach and health education services. As you know, the Essential Community Provider Program was enacted in 1994 as the state began to move the Medicaid program into managed care. Under PMAP, there was concern that these small safety net clinics might be left out of managed care networks. And over the years, the ECP program has worked well for both the ECPs and for the health plans, and is still working well today. The state's ECPs are uniquely qualified to care for a diverse population of patients with special needs and challenges, such as socioeconomic status, cultural background, or language needs. It is important that we preserve access for these patients and assure continuity of care by including these safety net clinics in managed care networks through this program. As healthcare costs continue to rise and the numbers of uninsured continue to rise, we will no doubt see major changes to the healthcare delivery system and to government program policies in the next few years. While these larger system issues are being addressed, it is critical that we maintain continuity of services for our patients. Continuing the ECP program is an important piece of that effort. Thank you for your time and attention, and I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for the witness members? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We do have one other testifier.
Yeah.
Paul Trow is an administrative manager for the Hennepin County Human Service and Public Health Department Mental Health Center.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm the administrator at the Hennepin County's Public Mental Health Center. We're the safety net mental health center for Hennepin County. Last year, we had about 28,000 visits in our center. We have large psychiatric staff. We follow a lot of patients who have serious and persistent mental illness and serious mental illness. We also serve a very large homeless population, homeless persons with mental illness, and that's, as you may know, a growing concern. And so one of the things that we're here for is to support this. Hennepin County had put in an application for this several years ago. It was a blanket application, but it was basically focused on the medical clinics within our complex of services, and we were not included, and through an oversight at this point, we're looking at the possibility of becoming an essential community provider. In fact, we are one. We are one of the core services within the county for providing clinical services to this population. We serve children and adults, and over time, we've increasingly serve persons who are on the PMATs. So let's say 10, 15 years ago, a lot of our folks were coming in through fee-for-service medical assistance. Typically now those clients come in and are on a health plan. This will help us with our reimbursements and will help us to continue to be able to provide services to this population. I think one of the facts that you might be interested in is probably 20 to about 33% of our population is uninsured, depending on how you count. If you're counting by visit or by a person, the figures vary, but either way, it's a large number of people that we are serving. Those are all people that are essentially served through property tax dollars, and of course, our intent is to try to lower that as much as possible, realizing that we will continue to make a contribution, but that it's helpful to bring in additional reimbursement. The ECP allows us to get a higher reimbursement rate, or at least to negotiate a higher reimbursement rate with the health plans, and so this is our intent in coming here to testify. Thank you.
Any questions for the witness members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says in the bill that prior to this bill being changed, that it says an application fee was to be determined by the commissioner. What was it that you were receiving from the department in years gone by as far as amounts of money that are a fee that you had to apply for?
I missed the first part of the question.
If I can answer, Chair Thiessen, I believe the fee that the commissioner was charging was $49.
Okay.
And this is raising it to $60.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions, members? Representative Abler, yes.
Just to the bill to comment, I got involved with ECPs as a freshman, and I helped to get President Dawkins that needed some help with a local clinic here that we managed to get status. And some things we do you don't know make a lot of difference, but some of the work of these clinics and home care providers and various mental health, various ones, do a tremendous amount of good for a very needy population. So
it's good they can go on.
Thank you, Representative Huntley. Representative Huntley.
Just a comment on the bill, Mr. Chair and members. These clinics actually do better in many measures in the state's community measurement reporting. They do better than the clinics in Edina. They do better than the clinics, most of the clinics in Duluth. They do a really good job without a lot of resources with a very difficult, in many cases, populations to deal with. And you will hear me say this again and again, and the reason they're good at that and doing that is because they coordinate the care that these individuals get and determine what the individual need is. In some cases, the biggest need may be a social worker. In other cases, it may be a neurosurgeon. But they coordinate that care, and the results have been really phenomenal.
Representative Mabel.
Just a final comment. And in terms of scrutinizing this preferred status, the Department of Health, and we'll hold them accountable, make sure they stay on their mission and do the work they said they would do in terms of reaching out and their targeting work that gives them this preferred status. So that's one more detail, I think, that people want to know. Thank you.
Representative Norton, any further comments?
No, sir.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Norton re-renews her motion that Senate File 555 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All in favor of that motion say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
Aye.
Okay, the motion is adopted and the bill will be sent to the General Register.
Thank you very much.
Representative Dietrich. I will move House File 636 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and we also have an amendment.
And Representative Dietrich, I'll move the A1-1 amendments, which is to get the bill in the order the author wants it. I think it just makes paragraph 3 longer and eliminates paragraph 4 as a separate paragraph, if I understand it correctly.
Technical in nature.
So everybody in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The A1A amendment is adopted. Representative Dietrich, to your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 636 seeks an exemption from the current requirements for dentists serving patients on medical assistance or Minnesota care. As you know, presently, a dentist who accepts the already mentioned health care plans is required to accept up to 10% of their patients from those health care providers. This bill provides an exemption from this requirement for dentists who are willing to serve unlimited children with special needs. I bring this bill forward on behalf of Dr. Michelle Meiser, who practices pediatric dentistry in my legislative district. Dr. Meiser is a pediatric dentist who is highly qualified to serve children with disabilities. Her practice is thriving. She does not need to open her office to children with disabilities who are on medical assistance, but she wants to. And I will, in a few minutes, let her speak to her dilemma in that situation. But I just want to make one other comment I really bring this bill forward on behalf of what I would say are some of the most vulnerable residents in my district. I call them vulnerable first because they are children. Secondly, is because they are children with disabilities. We are talking disabilities like Tourette's, autism, Down syndrome. Third, I call them vulnerable because they are currently restricted in choice for dental assistance. They are required to go to a certain group of dental providers instead of maybe somebody who is locally and highly qualified to deal with their special needs. And fourth, I call them vulnerable because they need to visit the dentist, which can be one of the most fearful life experiences for a child with disabilities. These children are the most challenging patients. The current law restricts access for children with disabilities to the most highly specialized, highly trained dentists, such as Michelle Meiser. And I believe that when a dentist who is specialized in something like pediatric dentistry and is willing to take the most vulnerable, difficult-to-treat clients that we ought to be able to adapt the law to provide for that service. Thank you. And now I will call on Dr. Meiser.
Dr. Meiser, please identify yourself for the record, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Michelle Meiser, and as you mentioned, I'm a pediatric dentist who opened up a practice in Coon Rapids 6 months ago, and I also practice in Maplewood. When I started my practice, I called the head of MA, and I had asked if it would be possible to sign up to treat children with special needs without signing up for the 10% of MA. After several months went by, they had contacted me back and said that that was not a possibility. I didn't quite understand that because being a pediatric dentist, after going to dental school, I went to 2 years more of schooling where all I did was treat children and a lot of children with special needs. I got to work closely with Dr. Bob Gorland, who has passed away since, but an amazing doctor who taught us a lot. We worked at Fairview Medical Center. We worked at HCMC. So we got to see a lot of children with different special needs. I feel that this qualifies me and allows me to treat these children in a way that other dentists can't. And I know that a lot of my colleagues who are pediatric dentists would also feel the same way and would be willing to take these children if you would allow us to do so. If you come to our office, you'll see that our office is very, very different than other dental offices. It's very kid-friendly. I mean, we've got bright orange, green, yellow walls. We've got footprints on the floors. We know that if a child comes in with autism, we know how to be patient and how to talk to the parents, how to communicate with the doctors to see if they need anything done. If they have blood disorders, we know how to work with the physicians to make sure that they have the proper medications before we do the treatment so that we are not putting these children at risk. As she had mentioned also, I could just go to work every day and never see an MA child in 6 feet. My office is thriving. I started in June and I already have 800 new patients. This is something that I feel morally that I need to do because I have training that someone else doesn't, and it just bothers me. I've done 3 years of public health, and I've seen what happens in public health settings where they strap kids down, and I'm sorry, I just get emotional over it. I mean, they strap them down, and they just do it. So I think that by them saying that we can't take care of these kids, that it's just ridiculous. And the parents get so upset because they call 100 places before they find someone where they can go. So, I think I've said what I need to say. I think that if you allow us to do this, children will be happier. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Spazzaro?
Well, my comments probably won't be as heartfelt, but I do want to indicate that when Rule 101 was originally enacted in the mid-90s, it was an attempt to encourage dentists to participate because we were seeing the beginnings of the dental access problem throughout the state. In fact, most dentists looked at it as an attempt to coerce them into a program that they weren't really happy to participate with in the first place. And I think the unintended consequence was that more dentists dropped out. They frankly used 101 as an excuse not to continue to serve the patients that they had for fear that they would get up to 20% of their client load medical assistance patients. And it's particularly problematic for doctors like Dr. Meisner, who have just come out of dental school and are facing $100,000 to $200,000 of debt, to get into a practice where you can, where you're losing money on patients that you see through this program. I have other ideas about how to fix that. Perhaps at a later date we can talk about that. But I do want to say that we've attempted to address this issue by lowering Rule 101 to a 10% threshold. I think that's done some good, but not, frankly, not enough. And in this case, finally, we are dealing with a group of very specialized dentists dealing with a very specialized and needy population. And it goes above and beyond the average dentist in dealing with this population. And these are people that we need. And if this will encourage them to participate in the program, by all means, I think it's a great idea, and I would encourage your support. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Okay.
Yeah, no, Representative Ava.
Well, I'm happy to be a co-author. I just have a question for this group to help me or the witness. Is there a fiscal note to this bill? Is this going to finance? Is there a fiscal note that will be attached to this? Is this going to finance because it's a go there? Is that right?
Actually, Representative Abrams, that's a good question.
Because actually, I'd love it if there was one, because we're told that there's plenty of access for the dentist, and so if you open up access to people who wish they could have gone somewhere, and then it costs us money, then it would prove that there wasn't access. But that's a different point. But I, is there a system?
There will be. We've been informed from the department that just because some more children may be treated. So that's,
and Mr. Chair, just
I don't know what the fiscal note is yet, though.
Yeah, I mean, whatever it is, we should find the money. If we do nothing else, we should do this one. And it'll be a, probably a relatively small fiscal note. But I've been saying all along, and you know as well as I, that dentists have a heck of a time serving people at these prices because they simply can't afford it. They would love to. Some of my local dentists have free dentist day. They have like Friday and Saturday. They dress up with little hats, and they all come in, and it's just like a happy day. And so the good doctor has something like that at her place. And they're in my old district, so it's a great place. But but this is
wait, another dress up in little hats, did you say?
Well, they have like the little smiley hats. So they have like all the kids who have bad insurance come in, and they have free dentists. They do free work, and it's I came and they do a picture, and it's just really kind of a, yeah. So they are it's outreach.
Maybe we should do that.
Smiley hats.
Sorry.
So, anyway, so I mean, the first point is this is something we should do, but it's curious that there's a fiscal note when it's a forecasted program and there's money available for who need it. But obviously, so I think that there's a, this is one good idea. There must be some other good ideas that dentists can find out to penetrate this market better and make sure these kids get proper care early on. So thank you.
Thank you. And Dr. Meiser, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. What's, just in terms of the time it takes to treat, like you treat kids with autism, is what, can you do a comparison? Just in terms of the kind of the rough time, does it take longer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it takes a lot longer for a couple of reasons. You're not only working with the child, but you're also working with the parents in those situations. The parents are always in the room. It takes longer to, a lot of times it takes 15, 20 minutes to warm them up to get in the chair. And then it takes another 15 to 20 minutes to get them to open up their mouth and be able to take a look. And then it takes a lot of time to explain what's going to happen at the next visit. A lot of these children are treated in a hospital setting, which is something that I meant to mention before, but I didn't. As pediatric dentists, we also have privileges to different hospitals. Mine are at Children's Hospital in St. Paul. So when these children have a lot of medical needs, I can consult with the doctors. I can piggyback cases, so if they need to have some other kind of surgery done, I can do the dental work at the same time, which is eliminating the need to do it in an office setting, which might be quite challenging. And it also takes a lot of time out of our office when we have to go and treat them in the hospital. So, you know, I can't really say that it takes double the time, because for some of the kids it's a lot more than that. So, but it definitely does take a lot more time.
Thank you. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dietrich, and for bringing this bill, and Dr. Meiser, for the work that you're doing. While you were talking, I was thinking about the many constituents that I have that would benefit from this, and that I've had the opportunity to work with children and adults that would benefit from this, and the adults in particular, I think back to what if we would have done this for them. And some of the teeth loss that they've incurred, or the multiple fillings and removal and caps that had to happen because they just were too afraid, and individuals weren't as trained as we know now to be able to deal with these individuals. And the most important person, actually, one of the most important people in my life, my ladybug, who actually will be 13, who brought me to work with this population in the past, has Down syndrome. And I was that individual that had to go to the dentist with her because her mother couldn't handle her. She would only listen to me. Otherwise, if I did not go, she was one of the individuals that would have to be strapped down. She was completely terrified and didn't listen to her mother, nor the dentist, nor the multiple other dental hygienists that had to come in to help calm her down. And so I thank you again for the work that you're doing, and I'm hopeful that we do move this along.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Doctor, just for my education, do pediatric dentists as specialists, do they typically charge more or cost more than normal dentists, for lack of a better term?
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that question is that our fees are very similar to the general dentist in our area. Every dentist has the right to pick their own fees, so I can't speak for every pediatric dentist. But in the sense that, you know, I think if you would just take a look at, you know, 100 dentists and you compared ours to theirs, it's pretty much the same. The difference is that we have the ability to make a little bit more money as pediatric dentists than general dentists because we do it every day. I mean, that's our specialty. So we've learned some of the tricks of the trade. I don't wear funny hats there, but I do have bunny masks and dog masks and cat masks. And I have, you know, Dora scrubs and things like that. And when the kids walk in the room and they see something like that, they don't, you know, get that initial fear. But if they walk into open bay clinic where there's just kids crying all over the place, they're going to get apprehensive. Or if they walk in somewhere where the guy comes in or the, you know, woman comes in with, you know, one solid outfit and their white jacket over the top, it's very intimidating. So I think in that sense, pediatric dentists have an advantage too.
Representative Liebling, and I think maybe this is going to be the last question because we have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Meisner. I'll save part of my question for Finance Committee, but I first of all, I just really wanted to commend you for the work that you do, and I also knew Dr. Gorlin, and it's great that you're carrying on that work. It's really wonderful, and also to commend you for the passion that you bring to the work, and I think I'll actually save my real question for the next committee. Thank you.
All right, seeing no further discussion, members, I will renew my motion that House File 636, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Dietrich and testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Representative Tao. Representative Tao will move House File 529. Mr. Representative Tao is coming up. I'd like to move to reconsider our motion adopting the minutes of the March 6th committee meeting. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? All right. And I'd like to offer an amendment. It's on page 2, and it's on the Emmer A-10 amendment. I think Representative Broad, I believe, voted no on that amendment.
Correct.
Okay. So, do we have to, okay, the motion to amend the minutes then to change the vote which says aye to no. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? That is adopted. And then, Representative Broad, will you move then that the minutes of March 6th is amended be adopted?
Yes, Mr. Chair, so move.
All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? All right. There we go.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you, members. I would like to move the DE2 amendment, please.
Representative Howell moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
With enthusiasm. That motion is adopted. Okay.
Okay, and now I promise Representative Huntley I'll take only 5 minutes because of the next bill. I have two testifiers, and we'll each probably make at least a minute. Essentially, this bill will ensure the insurance company will cover the elemental formula, also known as amino acid formula, for patients unable to eat anything whatsoever due to various severe medical conditions. Currently, the insurance industries are willing to pay for these formula if it's administered through the gastro-nasal tube. This poses a tremendous financial burden on a lot of the families who are already dealing with incredible medical ordeals. The formula, depending on the patient, can range anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 a year, which the parents will have to cover. So with this bill, we have agreement from both sides, the parents, the docs, and the healthcare industry. The amendment that we just adopted is that agreement, and so I'll just turn it over to the Dr. Stillman and one of the parents to give about a minute each to help explain the bill a little
bit. Thank you, Dr. Stillman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I thank you for allowing me to testify on this matter. That certain severe medical problems require the presentation of elementary amino acid building blocks of protein be administered in some in order to prevent severe life-threatening anaphylactic allergic reactions, in others to assist in the digestive and absorptive problems. The wrong formula can be and has been life-threatening. The correct formula is life-saving. The route of administration for many patients is immaterial. If a patient's going to have a life-threatening anaphylactic reaction to milk or cow's milk or soy, you give them a nasogastric tube, it's not going to save that patient. It's only for some patients who might need additional formula administration who might benefit from a nasogastric tube. The requirement from insurance companies that patients be malnourished before insurance coverage is also nonsensical. Patients who are going to die from an anaphylactic reaction are going to die before they're malnourished. So in conversations with the healthcare plans of Minnesota, we've come to an agreement on the coverage, and I would like to support it and request your support in this issue. In summary, the solution to the problem today is the correct solution. It is elementary.
Here we have one, the parent, Mr. Chair, Bart Hayes. He's going to make a brief comment.
Mr. Hayes, please identify yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Bart Hayes. I'm a parent of a child with a eosinophilic disorder. And we would just really like to request your support on this bill as it is. There's been a tremendous amount of hardship and difficulty with a lot of parents, many of whom are here today, and working with insurance companies, trying to get coverage, multiple appeal processes, and in spite of heavy documentation and letters from our doctors and care providers, we've really struggled to try and get coverage for this absolute medical need for our kids. It's the only way to feed our children. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming down today. President Powell?
Mr. Chair and members, did we move the bill to...
We need to do that, yes.
Yes.
We did move it. I moved it, and then I...
To the General Register? Or
going to the Commerce.
Oh, Commerce. Okay.
Yes. President Broad?
Mr. Chairman, just a question on that 62J, the mandate discussion that we've had previous to this. I just thought it was relevant in this case, too. And I didn't want to be neglecting that. I just wondered, maybe is that a request then would go to the Commerce Chair at this point?
Representative Broad, we are going to probably be doing that out of this committee, but this bill is one that the health plans have actually agreed, and they're going to be changing their medical policies to cover this, I believe, in any event, or move in that direction. So I think with regard to this one, there's actually agreement among the parties that this is something, it's a medical need that ought to be covered in. And so I don't know if it's as relevant in this on this particular bill.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I'm not arguing that discussion whether they're in agreement or not. I just wanted to make sure that if it's a mandate, which is, I think, what it does, whether people are in agreement or not, that I just want to bring up that and find out who the correct person would be in terms of making that request. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Broad, you can bring that up with me or with Representative Atkins. I think because that statute is discretionary and because the health plans have agreed here, my response on this particular bill of it wouldn't be sent to Commerce. So any further discussion on the bill, members? Okay, well, thank you to everybody who's worked on this bill. I think we've come to a good conclusion on this. So, anyway, all in favor of... Well, I guess President Powell will renew his motion that House File 529 be recommended to pass and as amended and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you very much for coming. Representative Huntley. Representative Huntley will move that House File 655 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Law. Representative Huntley, to your bill.
Well, waiting for another representative to join me, let me start. The this bill,
Representative Huntley, is the A1 amendment yours?
Let's see. A1 is mine.
Do you want to put that on now to get her? Okay. Representative Huntley moves that the A1 amendment be recommended, or be moves the A1 amendment. And it's to get the bill in the order the author prefers. Any discussion on that?
I can, Mr. Chair, it does a couple of things. One, it adds Tourette syndrome to the list of diseases that would be affected by this bill. It clarifies who can prescribe, which is in addition to physicians. It's got physician's assistant and advanced practice registered nurse. That's just in compliance with current state law. The lines 1-5 through 1-7 make clear that the physician or the prescribing person is responsible to that person's board, and inappropriate prescribing would be a reason for that board to take action. The next section about fair market value relates to part of their product is seized, and then it's found later that it should have been seized, then that there's a value put on it. The lines 113 through 121 describe what would happen if someone was in a nursing facility, and more typically actually would be in a hospice setting, how the that facility would deal with a patient that had prescribed the marijuana. Line 122 simply adds trains to all the kinds of vehicles that you, if you're using this for medicinal purposes, that you not operate those kinds of vehicles. And on the next page, subdivision 7 goes into a great length about the people that are being approved to provide the marijuana plants to individuals that receive a prescription from a physician, and makes quite clear that anybody with any sort of criminal record is not going to be allowed to be in these group of providers.
Okay, thank you. Representative Huntley's explained the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, of course. Mr. Chairman, do you want to entertain some questions on the amendment, or do you want to wait until it's part of the bill?
Why don't we put the amendment on? I think, and then
right.
I mean, it's up to members, but I
no, that's fine.
Okay. And then we certainly can have questions after that.
Mr. Chair, this amendment does not match up to this bill. Unless in our folders was the wrong engrossment of the. Of the bill.
I think this is the first plate that's gone, so it's...
All right.
The engrossment has to be right. So what are you looking at?
Let's just start with 1.2 on the amendment. This is going to be pretty embarrassing if I prove myself wrong right now.
You can just say you're stoned.
That looks correct. Why don't we hold off on the amendment for now while we check into that? Representative Huntley, do you want to just proceed with the bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll give a very brief introduction. I don't intend to go through the bill line by line. Other people can do that. But what this bill does is pass a law that says that a physician can give a script to an individual and allow that individual to use marijuana as a pain controller. This is aimed at people with unbearable pain, many of whom are dying of cancer or have other diseases. And to be blunt, it puts the state in conflict with federal law. We can legalize it here. 11 other states have already done this, and the federal government has not, so the federal government can do what they want to do, and the states apparently can do what they choose to do with this issue. We're not talking about large numbers of people. In the state of Colorado, which has had this in place since about, I think, 2001, they have about 200 patients that this applies to. So it's not a large number of people. It's people that a physician has decided that this treatment will help them. I want to make clear that you understand that the physician is the person that's really on the hook. If he writes a script for this, he has to answer to the medical board. And if his scripts are not appropriate, then he's putting his license on the line. I have heard from physicians on both sides of this issue, from Duluth. One's opposed. One is who does prescribe Marinol, said that he was sort of ambiguous about the bill. Marinol is the chemical, one of the chemical derivatives from marijuana, has to be taken orally, and it is used for pain control. It seems to work on some patients, does not seem to work well on others. And I have heard from physicians that support this. If you want to know who supports it, let me just go through a list here. The Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Public Health Association, Minnesota AIDS Project, Minnesota Senior Federation, AFSCME, the American Nurses Association, the American Public Health Association, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of HIV Medicine, the American Medical Student Association, the American Bar Association, and the Institute of Medicine, which is the nation's foremost group that evaluates medical services. And also by, it's also approved by the National Association of Attorneys General. So there's broad range support. We're talking about this being used by a very small group of people under physicians' direction. And there'll be lots of questions about its medical effectiveness, but I can tell you in the, written down here someplace, the February 13th issue of Neurology had an article, blinded study with people suffering from severe pain from AIDS, and it was highly significant in its ability to reduce their pain. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have our testifiers come up.
And Representative Huntley, before we do that, I think if you would amend or take a friendly amendment on your A1 amendment,
okay,
and on line 1.2, it should be page 2, line 3, so replace 31 with 3, and I believe with that change it fits the bill.
And I would accept that.
Okay, so can we just move the A1 amendment to get in the shape the author would like it to be? All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion's adopted. Okay, Representative Huntley, is Dr. Meerman, is that your first witness?
No.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Jacob Meerman, MD, and I would like to submit my testimony for this bill for the record. As a practicing physician, I treat people with a wide variety of illnesses. It's been my experience that there's no one-size-fits-all approach and that individual patients respond differently to different medications. It is therefore very important for doctors to have as many safe and effective options as possible. There is a great deal of evidence that marijuana can have therapeutic value in a wide range of circumstances. I believe that doctors should be free and should be indeed encouraged and expected to recommend this treatment option when they feel would be of benefit for the individual patient. Currently, patients for whom standard drugs are not effective and who might benefit from medical marijuana are left with two terrible choices. One is to continue to suffer from ineffective treatment and debilitating illness, and two, to obtain marijuana illegally and then suffer the legal consequences. This is not a situation that any sick or suffering person should have to endure. This bill represents a simple recognition that the sick and dying should not be turned into criminals for attempting to treat their illness in the manner that their physician feels that's most appropriate. Further, I'd like to say that many drugs which we legally prescribe for many conditions are much more dangerous than marijuana and as well as much more addictive. For example, drugs like hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, Vicodin, and others are very addictive narcotics. Things like Xanax, Ativan, Valium, and others are very addictive tranquilizers or downers. Ritalin and other amphetamines are stimulants or uppers, which are legally prescribed to our children, for ADD mostly. All these drugs have high street value, and yet, at the same time, they are legally prescribed by many doctors on a regular basis. Many other drugs just have bad side effects and are still prescribed legally. Some predictably kill a small percentage of people taking them by inducing all kinds of illnesses, such as, for example, heart attacks and bleeding ulcers, as in case of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, such as Vioxx, Celebrex, naproxen, ibuprofen, etc. Marijuana does not even come close to the dangers exhibited by these drugs, and yet they are legal and marijuana is not. And what about the other non-prescription drugs that are much more addictive than marijuana and kill many thousands of people per year and yet are available in the local supermarkets? I'm talking about alcohol and tobacco. As far as I know, marijuana is less dangerous and addictive than these, and yet it is illegal for use even on a doctor's recommendation, which does not make much sense to me at all. I understand that 11 other states already allow doctors to recommend marijuana to their patients. I sincerely hope that Minnesota will join this year. If this bill passes, many suffering Minnesotans will benefit from it. I can take any questions. I just spoke with a colleague of mine just leading to come here, Dr. Paluhina, in our clinic. She is a pain specialist. She said, tell them I am all with you. You know, I really support this as well. So,
thank you. Albert Nagalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just a few questions. Are there other ways to consume THC, the active ingredient, if you will, in marijuana?
Either Representative Huntley or...
Should I answer? It's my understanding that it can be smoked or it can be put into an inhaler, and there's a device that heats it up and then you inhale the vapors. There's no smoking involved, which would probably be more appropriate.
I am wondering if either Representative... I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Representative Huntley, or if the testifiers could describe the process. One thing I've been trying to get my head around is I understand the bill says you can't purchase marijuana from outside the state, which implies to me it's going to be grown in state. Can you describe how we would do the growing, the packaging, the harvesting, the packaging, the processing, sales? That process would be helpful to know that.
Please identify yourself.
Hi, my name is Neil Levine. I'm director of Minnesota for Compassionate Care. Under the bill, There would be several ways that patients could procure marijuana. One is the bill would allow patients to grow a limited number of plants. If they were unable to, they could designate a caregiver to do that on their behalf. And if they were unable to find a designated caregiver to do that on their behalf, there could, if a registered and licensed nonprofit wanted to act as the surrogate caregiver for a patient, that would also be allowed under the bill. There's a lot of very strict safeguards in the bill in regards to these nonprofits. They can only grow the allowed amount of plans per patient, or as many patients as they have registered with the organization. They could not grow the marijuana before they had a patient and then try and get patients. They could only have plants for the patients they already had registered with the organization. And where we were actually, there would be some sort of inspection of these premises, and there's an increased penalty on these nonprofits. So if someone did have the idea that they wanted to open one of these nonprofits as a way to try and legally sell drugs, they would actually be facing a stiffer penalty than if they just tried to sell drugs on their own. So this is tightly designed based on the existing laws in 11 other states to really try and help suffering Minnesotans.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So if I'm understanding it correctly, these, say, a nonprofit organization is set up to grow and provide marijuana for these patients, they'd only be allowed to have so many plants, and they couldn't grow them before they have the demand. So
yeah.
A patient would come to them and say, I would like to purchase marijuana from you, and then they could go ahead and grow it?
The patient would have to designate them as their designated caregiver, their designated nonprofit caregiver, and then under the currently under the bill, the amount per patient that's allowed is 12 plants. So at that point, once the patient was registered with the nonprofit, they could have up to 12 plants per patient that they had registered.
Mr. Chair.
Over the devil, sure.
Thank you. So, for example, if 12 patients came to him, or 10 patients came to him, they could have 120 plants.
But those plants would be designated for each individual patient, and they can only have the individual patients can only have up to 2.5 ounces of usable marijuana on them. So, yes, they could have that per patient.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Sure.
If I may. With these other states, 11 other states that are doing this, do they experience problems with the system as far as illegal uses, you know, leakage of the system, causing other problems?
That's an excellent question. In the 11 other states, the laws differ slightly from state to state. Three of the states have passed the laws through the legislative process. Eight have passed through ballot initiative. The most current state to pass is Rhode Island, which the limits in Rhode Island are also 12 plants, 2.5 ounces. And for the most part, when you hear about problems with the existing laws, you hear about California. And California was the first state to pass it. And what we're talking about here is not what we have in California. The California initiative was 8 lines, and if you take a look at the bill, we're talking about pages and pages. This is really sort of a narrowly crafted, tightened bill that we've learned from the experience in other states. The vast majority of the other states do not exhibit problems. To the extent where an issue has risen up, people were not protected by the medical marijuana law. So people have gone outside the law. Very few people have gone outside the law, and those people have been prosecuted, and the medical marijuana law gave them no safe haven. So for the vast majority of these states, no, we do not see issues. There's no movement to repeal any of these laws in these other states. In fact, any time that a legislature has taken up any of these existing laws, they've moved to expand these laws, not even retract them. Right now, they're currently moving to expand the law in Vermont. They've already expanded the law in Maine. They expanded the law in Oregon. So these laws are popular. They work well. And they don't cause a lot of the doom and gloom that you might hear from some of the opponents of the bill. It just doesn't happen.
Thank you. Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And I'm not sure, the first doctor, I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Dr. Merman?
Dr. Norman?
Merman.
Merman.
M-I-R-M-A-N.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Merman, what kind of a doctor? You said MD. What's your specialty?
I'm an internist.
And Mr. Chair, Dr. Merman, an internist, how does that differ, say, from an orthopedic specialist or from a rheumatologist or a neurologist? How would an internist differ?
I'll tell you what I do. We basically treat a wide variety of conditions, and when we feel that we're not enough, then we send them to specialists. So people come to us with all kinds of pains, with injuries, with chronic pain, back pain, whatever. We do prescribe any drugs that we consider necessary, including narcotics.
Is that a good answer?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
Dr. Merman, that is an excellent answer, because what I'm trying to bring out, and I want to make it clear, that you would be the first line of defense if an adult patient has to go to his or her clinic. They will typically start with an internist, and then the internist will determine if you have some greater need of care. Even though you can prescribe, you would refer to the appropriate specialty. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. And especially with pain, with chronic pain, we refer patients to pain clinics on a regular basis. I am personally not too comfortable dealing with narcotic addictions, and there are specialists for that.
That's fantastic. That's, Mr. Chair, that's excellent, because that's what I wanted to ask you about. In your practice, Dr. Merman, you do prescribe pain-killing medications, right?
Yeah, when necessary.
Mr. Chair, if I could just continue, one of those might be Vicodin.
Yes.
And that is a drug that needs to be prescribed, right?
Yes.
Now, I'm going to draw an analogy and ask you a question, because I've heard both of the testifiers, Representative Huntley, testify about how tightly this bill is written. And the point I would like to have clarified for me is on that issue. When it comes to Vicodin, let's say that Vicodin, a drug that you prescribe, is grown in plant form, and that anyone at this table could grow a Vicodin plant, or a plant that would allow you to create Vicodin, and then they could cook it in their own home and create the Vicodin. If that could happen, that's essential. Well, let me ask you, would that be allowed? Can someone manufacture Vicodin today in their own home?
Ms. Dr. Mayor.
Well, you can't manufacture it. This one is a synthetic narcotic.
Okay.
You can manufacture things like morphine, probably, opium, which is really not a legal drug, but morphine is a derivative of it, and Vicodin is a derivative of that. But basically, it's on the same line.
Mr. Member.
But morphine...
Representative Abler is back for this line of questioning. Representative Emmer.
Well, I don't think he prescribes, though.
No, I'm...
He might imbibe, but he doesn't prescribe. I apologize. I'll withdraw that. That was very uncalled.
Better than ever.
No, this is. I am trying to be serious, Dr. Merman. When it comes to the issue, whether it's a synthetic or other, there's a reason why we allow. We have tight regulations on the manufacture and distribution of drugs. Again, whether it's synthetic or derivatives of some natural substance, there is a reason why we regulate those. And when you prescribe them, it requires a pharmacist to actually. There's a chain of custody of that drug before it is released to the patient. Is that right?
Yes, of course. Of course, you can also buy it on the street. To me, it's very similar.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'll just leave it at this. Representative Huntley, your bill, it allows folks to grow their own marijuana plants and process their own marijuana in their own home. Isn't that correct?
Representative Huntley,
that would be correct.
Okay. I'll save the rest for later, Mr. Chair.
If I can...
Representative Huntley.
Just to add one thing. The federal government actually does have a program that supplies smokable marijuana to a small number of individuals with chronic pain. Representative Emmer has sort of touched on the problem area of this bill. I personally have no problem with the physician prescribing marijuana. And I wish the person could go to the drugstore and buy it, but we can't do that given federal law. So somehow we have to do it. And what we're doing is setting up a program just like the federal government has, except we're going to allow the people to grow the marijuana. And I say, it's the physician that's on the hook for this. If he's prescribing it to somebody that shouldn't have it, he's the one that's in big trouble.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
I have to do this. I get along with the author very well, but the elephant in the room, I just have to ask him, because he's also the author of another bill that would seek to ban smoking. And I'm looking at Representative Huntley. I'm looking at a handout that came with your materials that at the top it says to inhale or not to inhale. And I go down about halfway, and it says, according to the Merck Manual of Diagnosis and Therapy, although many dangers of marijuana are frequently cited, there is still little evidence of biologic damage, even among relatively heavy users. I was reading that, and I was just thinking about the... there seems to be a bit of a conflict between the information that's been presented on these two bills, and I would just ask you... and hopefully it'll be taken in the right spirit with a little levity. Is this bill, if it's passed into law, will someone with the appropriate registration card be able to smoke their medical marijuana in a restaurant or a bar in the state of Minnesota?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I'm always, when I'm in this position, I remember the there was a editorialist back in the 30s, E.B. White, that said that consistency is a paste jewel cherished only by cheap men. And
on the House File 655. Representative Tao.
Back to thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Back to Representative Gottwald's point, first point about other methods. Back in college, a couple of guys told me that they were able to add it into brownies.
So, Representative Finstead.
I don't even know how to follow any of this up. thank you, Mr. Chair. To the last point that. Do you want questions related to the bill yet, or do you want testimony? I don't want.
Well, why don't we take some more testimony? Representative Broad, if you have for this witness.
Well, actually, for one of the doctors.
Okay.
And I didn't catch. It's not Dr. Merman. It's
Mr. Levine. Is that right? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I'm not a doctor.
Oh,
I'm the director of Minnesotans for Compassionate Care, which is the organization that's organizing the support behind this bill.
My apologies. Mr. Levine, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Levine, I'm just wondering, in that amendment, there's a term in there called a registered organization, and I'm just wondering, with your experience and your information from the other 11 states, I'm trying to understand what that actually is, what is the entity, how does it function, things like that.
Ms. Levine.
Mr. Chair, if I understand the question, I believe that you're referring to the nonprofits that I had alluded to before.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm looking on the amendment page 1, line 11. It talks about we changed essentially the fair market value to just the value of the marijuana, but it says unless the cardholder shows that he or she bought the marijuana from a registered organization at a different price, and I'm just trying to get at that piece and what that actually means.
What's a registered organization?
Exactly.
Sure. Yeah, that would be alluding to if a patient were registered with one of these nonprofits, if they came into existence that I alluded to before. So what the goal of this amendment was trying to put some sort of quantifiable figure on what fair market value would be. So the specifics there were $200 per ounce unless they had paid more than that, and they could show that they paid more than that if they're registered to run these nonprofits.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to this gentleman here. Back to Representative Gottwald. He asked you about the 12-plant growing ability. He referenced the caregiver that might have 10 patients, I believe. You talked about 120 plants. You said those plants need to be specified per patient, correct? Is that what you stated?
If this was one of these nonprofit organizations, correct.
All right. Mr. Chair, so my question is, if they have 12 plants for one patient identified, that patient, for whatever reason,
no longer needs the plants. Does this bill call for proper disposal? What happens to those plants that are currently being grown?
That's an excellent question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but if it doesn't, we'd have no issue with putting an amendment in that said those would have to be immediately destroyed.
Representative Vincent?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as the bill we have in front of us right now, it doesn't address that issue at all. So if someone were to, heaven forbid, pass away or decide not to do this anymore, the nonprofit or whoever is growing this marijuana plants, there's no information at all in this bill, and there's no idea right now from the author or from the groups proposing this bill how to handle these plants that would now be, I suppose, legally grown in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair and Representative, they could have those plants if the person they had been selling them to died or was no longer going to use it, then I assume they would have to destroy those 12 plants because they can't have more than the number of patients that they have signed up.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, if I may, the beauty of the legislative process is that what we're interested in doing is presenting the most tightly crafted bill as possible for the goal of helping sick and dying Minnesotans, allow them who are right now using marijuana to alleviate their pain and risking arrest and doing it privately. So, we are very open, and the sponsors from Conversation I know are very open to amending the bill or to the extent that there might be a weakness in the bill. We're certainly open to working with all sides and amending it, however, to make it as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just my final thought on that, then, we've heard the word tightly crafted bill three times already, and we've just now found a hole you could probably drive a Mack truck through. Let's be open and honest about this. There are some holes in this bill. I don't think it's right for us to say this is tightly crafted at this point. And I don't care if we cut and paste this from another state. And if it works in another state, good for them. But, this is Minnesota. We have the opportunity here to vote this up, vote this down, make it better, make it worse, whatever it may be. But I would by no means say that this bill is tightly crafted at this point.
Well, and Representative Vincent, I think Representative Huntley's point is that all this it would be illegal to have more than the number of plants. So by implication, I think, and we can certainly take an amendment, I suppose, but by implication, if someone is no longer going to be using it, you couldn't have that number of plants, or it would be illegal, so you'd have to destroy them. So
yeah, and that's the exact point that I'm making, Mr. Chair, is how do you dispose of them? Do you throw them out in the garbage and let some high school kid come by and pick them up as they walk by?
You stop watering them, I suppose. Representative,
then they dry up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have one more question for Mr. Levine, and then one more question for Representative Huntley before we move on to the other testifiers as well. Mr. Levine, I'm looking at page 10, line 25, and it talks about reasonable notice giving shall be given prior to inspection. I'm wondering, in your experience in the other states, has that reasonable notice in terms of spot checks been used? And it seems to me that we're giving additional notice in this case that we may not be giving in other cases, such as alcohol and tobacco. So I'm wondering where that came from and what your thoughts are in that regard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is actually one of an added provision that doesn't exist in a lot of other states as a way to tighten up the bill to allow for inspection.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Brock?
And Mr. Levine, and Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how that tightens the bill.
Mr. Chair, it allows for inspection of specifically the aim of that provision is to allow for inspection of these nonprofits if they were to exist. Whereas, per your question, how it works in other states, as far as I know, that provision doesn't exist in other states. So the aim of that provision was to put oversight on these nonprofits.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Levine, in that case, you're suggesting that states have no oversight. The other 11 states have no oversight over these nonprofit organizations that are selling this product.
Mr. Levine,
Mr. Chair, the currently the That's correct. The states that allow would allow a nonprofit dispensary type organization, they are in the process of trying to tighten that down. The specific example is California. And like I said, it was this ballot initiative that consisted in totality of 8 lines. And the wording that created these organizations was a sentence. So the goal here is to learn from that and to try and present something that is tightly organized.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question for Representative Huntley, and then I'll be done.
Well, one more, and then we have several questions, but I'd like to just get to the test part. Mr. Levine will stay here and be able to answer questions later.
That's great, Mr. Chairman. I think it'll just help me to be able to find some things along the way. But Representative Huntley, can you tell me where I should look to find in the bill where it says where the smoking can occur? Is there anything in the bill, or what page of the bill does it say where this activity can occur? Can it occur in hospitals? Is it just private homes? I'm just trying to get a sense of how tight that is.
President Huntley. I think Section 6 may be a place to look. And Representative Finstead, to your question, I would take a look at page 6, lines 31 to 34. And while maybe they can figure that out as they're going, I'd like to call the next testifiers down. Mr. Hammond and Mr. Stenberg. And we'll get back to the answer on that question, Representative Broad. If you just want to speak into this microphone and pull over a chair there, that would be great. Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record for us.
Okay. Hello. My name is Don Homan.
And Mr. Homan, thank you for the correction. And we're running out of time, so brevity would be great.
Okay. I'll read thank fast. You. I've had serious liver disease and other related conditions for nearly 3 decades. About 15 years ago, this viral illness progressed to the stage of cirrhosis, which is ongoing and irreversible. My symptoms have included anorexia and nausea. Besides that, I have ongoing pain from degenerative disc disease, osteoarthritis, and myofascial pain syndrome. Recently, I underwent spinal neurosurgery. Because of nerve-related complications, I now walk with the help of an orthotic brace that is attached to my leg and foot. Before moving to Minnesota, I lived in California, where voters, as you know, have approved the regulated use of marijuana for medical purposes. Between 1981 and 1994, I went through 3 extended courses of treatment using the sometimes effective but toxic drug interferon. This approach proved unsuccessful. My doctor then suggested I use marijuana to ease my pain, control the nausea, and maintain my weight. So I registered as a medical marijuana patient and was issued an ID card. This allowed me to buy limited portions of the drug from privately run dispensaries. My certification was reviewed on a regular basis. My doctor and I agreed that marijuana works for me. When I use a small amount, my body's metabolism has no idea that my actions are not okay under Minnesota law. What is clear is that I feel better, I look healthier, and I am healthier. This treatment has enabled me to live a more independent and productive life. The bill before you would further help me in 2 ways. First, it would help me protect me from the risks and dangers of criminal prosecution. And it would help improve the quality and therefore the safety of this effective medicinal treatment. I was born in this region, and I feel that most Minnesotans can accept the use of marijuana for medical purposes, as long as it is done systematically and responsibly. HF-655 can provide effective relief for many of us who are seriously ill, and in a manner that is safe for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witness, members? Member, I think we're going to have Mr. Backstrom come up at this point. Yes, Representative Gumbel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask a question, if I could, of the recent testifier. I do want. Have you found relief from anything other than the marijuana?
Not really. I've tried Marinol. I've tried about 6 different anti-nausea medications. I have used Vicodin, oxycodone, but they all have side effects. And obviously I can't use alcohol. So just because of my liver disease, my choices are limited.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baxter. And Mr. Pritchard, if you want to, you'll be next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I asked one of your clerks to pass out 2 handouts that I have with me today. My name is James Backstrom. I'm the Dakota County Attorney. I am the president-elect of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and also a member of the Board of Directors of the National District Attorneys Association. First of all, I'd like this committee to know that while I and my colleagues have great compassion for individuals who suffer from serious illnesses and diseases, I do not believe that marijuana is an appropriate or safe medical treatment. In fact, it is very harmful and an addictive substance. Legalizing it for medical use will have many unintended consequences, which I'd like to discuss with you for a few moments this afternoon. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association strongly opposes any efforts to legalize marijuana for medical use in our state, and we're not alone in our opposition to this proposal. This proposal is also opposed by Minnesota's Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police Association, the National District Attorneys Association, and the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. There are many reasons why these law enforcement agencies strongly oppose the passage of this law. First of all, marijuana is an addictive substance that poses significant health consequences to its users, including those who may be using it for medical purposes. Marijuana has no proven medical value. It is not supported for medicinal use by many prominent health organizations. There already exists a legalized form of medical marijuana. It's called Marinol, which can deliver in controlled doses the THC that marijuana provides to patients in the form of a pill, which can be regulated and monitored by a physician, and the dosage is controlled. It simply cannot control the dosages nor the quantity of THC in a smoked form of marijuana. Marijuana's use as a medicine is contrary to federal law, as you've heard today, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court. It is a dangerous drug that is associated with many crimes of violence in our state and across this country, and it is far more powerful today, 10 to 30 times more powerful than it was in the 1960s and 1970s, and it serves as a gateway to the use of other illegal drugs. Legalizing marijuana for medical purposes will lead to increased use of marijuana by other persons, increased crime, and the perception that marijuana is harmless when, in fact, it is far from.
Mr. Backstrom, what are you relying on for those statements?
I'm relying on all of these are documented in the Minnesota County Attorneys Association policy position. Every one of those statements is documented with footnotes, hundreds of footnotes on the end of the document. If you'd like to look up the sources for the statements, please do so. But they're there in the document that I've handed out today, and I think I previously mailed to members, but I'm not certain if you got it before this afternoon. And some of these are my own opinions in terms of that legalizing marijuana will increase dangers associated with impaired driving and other crimes. You know, those are my interpretations as a prosecutor for over 20 years in this state and a long area of familiarity with illegal drug use and abuse in our state. I'd like to point out a couple of specific things in terms of the medical uses of marijuana. Bear in mind that...
And Mr. Backstrom, I'm looking at the point that you just made about the gateway drug,
mm-hmm.
and it appears that is not, those citations are not dealing with medical marijuana, but marijuana in general. I think that's an important clarification. So go on with your testimony.
Thank you for that, but I believe that this bill, if passed, will result in a much larger use of marijuana by those who are not using it for medical purposes as well, particularly amongst our state's youth, which causes those of us in law enforcement great concern. In terms of the medical issues specifically, you know, I think it's important for this committee to note that the American Medical Association, the largest association of doctors in this country, has not endorsed the use of marijuana for medical purposes, nor has the National Sclerosis Association, the American Glaucoma Association, the American Academy of Ophthalmology, or the National Eye Institute, or the National Cancer Institute. All of these associations do not believe that marijuana is an appropriate use in terms of medicine. The most specifically, in April 20th of 2006, the Federal Drug Administration, which is our national organization to regulate the distribution of medications in a safe form to our nation's citizens, has indicated that there is no sound scientific study that has supported the medical use of smoked marijuana for treatment in the United States. I think it's important to note that particular point as well. The Institute of Medicine, which is often cited by supporters of medical marijuana bills as supporting this, when you look at it in its detail of the entire report of that particular institution, they do no such thing. They discount the notion that smoked marijuana is or ever can become a medicine. And that particular report indicated that the effects of cannabinoids on the symptoms studied are generally modest, and in most cases there are more effective medications than smoked marijuana. And at best, the IOM stated in its report, there is only anecdotal information on the medical benefits of smoked marijuana for some ailments, and for others, including epilepsy and glaucoma, they found no evidence of medical value. And they concluded that there is little future in smoked marijuana as a medically approved medication. These are the reports that are being cited to you as supporting the medical use of marijuana. I don't think they do that. And I encourage you to look at the details of those reports before you enact this particular bill. I would specifically point out to you, and I think this is perhaps the most important point of all, is that marijuana is a Schedule I controlled substance that has been that is regulated by the federal government. Schedule I controlled substances are the most restricted drugs under federal law. They are drugs that have a high potential for abuse. They lack any accepted medical use, and they have an absence of accepted safety criteria for use in medically supervised treatment. The possession, manufacture, or distribution of marijuana, as you have heard, as a Schedule I substance, is a federal crime. I do not believe it is sound public policy for the legislature of this state to pass a law which encourages law-abiding citizens of our state to commit a federal crime. Marijuana is subject to supervision, clear supervision by the federal government, and I believe that's where its supervision should remain. I would point out through the committee, and it's also cited in the report that I handed out to you, the county attorney's position paper, the specific provisions that the United States Supreme Court used, some of the language they used when they supported the federal government's authority to regulate marijuana in any state in America, notwithstanding laws of this nature being passed. The United States Supreme Court concluded that the, and I quote, the exemption of cultivation by patients and caregivers can only increase the supply of marijuana in the state market. I quote, the likelihood that all such production will promptly terminate when patients' medical needs during their convalescence seems remote, whereas the danger that excesses will satisfy some of the admittedly enormous demand for its recreational use seems obvious. I quote, the fact that the national and international narcotics trade has thrived in the face of vigorous criminal enforcement suggests that no small number of unscrupulous people will make use of state exemptions to serve their commercial ends whenever it is feasible to do so. Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe that that is exactly what will occur if this bill becomes law in our state. it will expand the use of marijuana throughout our society for illegal purposes, and that is where it raises a significant danger to our youth and the potential gateway to using even more dangerous illegal substances.
Thank you, Mr. Backstrom. We do have one witness that has come from out of town. Before we get to you, if we could have Mr. Packin come down. And members, I'm thinking we're not going to get to a vote on this bill today. I'm not sure, but we'll still try. Mr. Packin, please identify yourself for the record. If I have the name right, then.
My name is Shannon Packin. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Shannon, and I'm here to testify in favor of HF 655, the medical marijuana bill. As an athlete who suffers from a neurological disorder known as Tourette syndrome, I have used medical marijuana in the past and found it to be the most reliable treatment I have encountered over a lifetime of medication. This is actually the second time I've come to the Capitol to testify in support of medical marijuana legislation. On February 14th, I testified before the Senate Health, House, and Family Securities Committee in favor of the Senate's version of this bill. I was then featured in an article in the Sunday Star Tribune. I would like to transpire next to be the focus on my testimony today. Just yesterday, 2 days after the Star Tribune story ran, I received word from my 15-year-old son that he was interrogated during the school day by school officials. They wanted to know whether his parents grew marijuana, whether they kept it in the house, or whether they had been seen using it. Mr. Chairman, my son was born with a birth defect, which affects his speech patterns and on occasion his comprehension. He didn't know exactly what was going on, except that he was being singled out, questioned, and treated like a criminal himself, and made to feel foolish. Mr. Chairman, let me please emphasize that this happened because I became before the legislation as a good American and citizen to testify in favor of this bill. During the Senate hearing, County Attorney Backstrom, whom I presume is present today, stated that law enforcement should be just as concerned about cancer patients using medical marijuana in hospice as they are about meth dealers on the street. I would like to know, do Mr. Backstrom and others opposed to this bill believe that challenged children should be harassed and frightened because their parents participate in the democratic process? Because this is exactly what happened to my son yesterday afternoon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you have the power to make this stop. I should not be a criminal for treating the symptoms of my illness. I am not a criminal for coming here to voice my support for this bill, and my son should not be treated like a criminal on the basis of being my son. Please stop this today. You have the power to protect patients like myself from arrest, jail, and our families from unnecessary hardship. Please vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Any questions for the witness members? Mr. Pritchard.
Oh. Are we going to have a chance to ask Attorney Backstrom?
Yeah. Sure. Why don't we have Mr. Pritchard go here quickly and then?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to testify in opposition to the bill. I think we share the same goal with Representative Huntley of wanting to reduce pain and suffering among people who experience still debilitating diseases and conditions, but we believe that this bill will in fact put the public's health at risk. This bill goes far beyond even focusing on terminally ill people. We believe it circumvents the process for approving drugs to ensure that they're safe and people understand what they're using. I think that maybe give an analogy, basically what the legislature is being asked to do here is to substitute their judgment for the FDA. And I guess I'd ask you, would you take a drug that's being recommended by the Minnesota State Legislature or the FDA to prescribe or recommend for your child? I think we'd go with the FDA. I think, let's be clear, obviously marijuana is a...
Well, Mr. Pritchard, just to clarify, it would be the doctor that would be prescribing it, not the legislature.
Mr. Chair, but I think the legislature is serving in the role of the FDA of approving a drug and saying it's safe to be used and to be recommended, and obviously the FDA hasn't done that with this medication, so I see their roles being analogous. I think realize that marijuana is a very dangerous drug. It was already pointed out it's a controlled one substance. The medical marijuana potency has doubled over the past 10 years. It's now 20 times the potency of marijuana smoked in the 1960s. It's a mind-altering drug, and it's more dangerous than alcohol. People are five times more likely to be admitted to an emergency room for marijuana use than for alcohol. Marijuana is addictive. More children are admitted to treatment for marijuana use than for alcohol use. So I will admit that some people experience relief from nausea and pain from smoking marijuana, but that's not where the discussion should end. It's just where it should begin, because if you get prescription, they give you information on the particular conditions that the drug is effective for, the risks, the benefits, the dosage frequency, the refills for adults and children, interaction with other drugs, prescription on other pre-existing conditions, and alternatives to marijuana use. But you don't have any of that with marijuana. Basically, there is no restrictions whatsoever. It was already mentioned, a number of the medical associations which have opposed this, and I think it's very clear that they see that the dangers outweigh any benefits from smoked marijuana. And I think we have to look at the legislation, and I really believe this bill would blow the doors wide open in terms of restrictions on marijuana use. If you look at the definition on Section 2, Subdivision 4, you can distill that down to say a chronic medical condition that produces chronic pain. I mean, what is that? Is that a tennis elbow, a sore knee? It's wide open. There's no restrictions. People oftentimes say this is dealing with terminally ill people, but the definition is wide open.
Again, Mr. Pritchett, though, it would have to be prescribed by a doctor, I believe.
Yeah. And as far as the amounts, Section 2, Subdivision 2 allows for the possession of 2.5 ounces. Well, that's the equivalent of 70 cigarettes on the person at one time, but yet they can go back for pretty much an unlimited supply. And let me point out how unlimited that supply can be. For each patient, there can be 12 plants grown or to supply marijuana. Each plant will provide between 1 to 5 pounds of smoked marijuana a year. For 12 plants, that's equal to 12 to 60 pounds of marijuana per year. So for 5 patients, you can grow 60 plants. That's between 60 and 300 pounds of marijuana that these people can grow. That translates, those 60 to 300 pounds translates into 27,240 joints to 136,200 joints. That's a lot of marijuana. And yet there are no restrictions on this marijuana. And I think we have to be aware that, you know, where's the quality control in the use of the drug? There's no restrictions on where it can be grown. It can be grown in the basement. Who can grow it? An 18-year-old boy can be growing and supplying people with marijuana. I think that should be of concern. To look at how this is being abused in other states.
Mr. Pritchett, I think we're going to have to have you come back tomorrow. We're going to have to recess at this point. And members, I think we'll take this bill. Excuse me? We're going to adjourn, yes. Oh, yes, sorry, not recess. We're going to adjourn at this point, and we'll have to come back tomorrow and finish up this bill, members. We're at 2:45. We're adjourned.